Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 120, recorded Saturday, March 12th, 2016. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: where do guidebooks fit in? And I hate shopping for a suitcase. Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, after a much longer than intended break. Looking back at the Google Docs revision history for this episode, the notes for this episode, I started writing it on February 2nd. So I had the best of intentions, but have pretty much been traveling nonstop since then, at which point you might reasonably say, but Mark, you've got all this time in airports and hotels to write, which should be the case, but I find that I have to remove all possible distractions before I can write, hence the lack of any journalism career for me. So instead, I just keep jotting ideas down in Evernote, feeling like I'm making progress, but not ever buckling down to actually write an episode. And until a week or so ago, when Dan Gradwald sent me an email with the subject line, "Mark, where's the next Travel Commons?" You know, asking in a very nice way, "When are you going to get off your ass?" I snarled back at Dan a bit, more at frustration with myself than anything he wrote, but it did get the intended result, so I dedicate this episode to Dan. The travel that got in the way wasn't anything exotic, just sort of the usual sort of bouncing around New Orleans, Las Vegas, Atlanta, Boston, New Jersey, but it was at the tail end of 7 weeks of straight travel, which is right about the time I hit my fun quotient. My patience dives and my bitch tweeting climbs. Of course, the fact that my American Airlines flights were hitting a 50% on time rate didn't help. I think I finally tipped over when I found my Newark to O'Hare flight was an ancient American Airlines MD-80 trying to wedge my bag long ways into the short overhead bin on the AB side was just, I got to tell you, it was a complete throwback to when I first started traveling for business in 1985 on American Airlines out of Dallas-Fort Worth on MD-80s. 30 years later, I find myself on the same plane with less legroom and no peanuts. I am gearing up for some fun travel this month, though. I'm trying out Iceland Air's new Chicago to Reykjavik service with my son, and then trying out Iceland's budget carrier, Wow Air. There you go. There's a name. Wow. I hope it's a wow experience. Anyhow, I'm taking them then out of Reykjavik to meet up with my wife and daughter in Spain. I'm hoping it all works fine, but I got to tell you, I'm mentally preparing myself to have to call a couple of audibles. Following up, Peter Zurich sent a great note adding on to the digital security topic in the last episode. Peter writes, "Your suggestion to switch to cellular network as opposed to airport Wi-Fi is okay, but it is becoming easy to obtain technology to set up a rogue cell site that will silently capture traffic. Your data will be caught and you will be none the wiser. Thus, in my opinion, it is still very important to only use HTTPS encrypted websites, and I would still add on the VPN if you have one available. Bottom line, when using any website where you need your password to access sensitive information, make sure the computer is trusted, no public access, borrowed, loaner computers, and make sure the website is HTTPS. If using Outlook or applications other than the web browser, you should be on your company's VPN. Second thing, people should be aware that tearing a 2D barcode in half doesn't necessarily render it undecipherable. 2D barcodes have a configurable level of redundancy built in, so that even if part or possibly most of the barcode is missing or unreadable, it can still be decoded. My personal policy is once we have confirmed our frequent flyer miles have been posted, the boarding passes go in the shredder. Hey, Peter, thanks for these comments. I really appreciate it. You know, 2 weeks ago, there was a story in the USA Today about a columnist whose email was hacked while he used Gogo's Wi-Fi service on an American Airlines flight. And I think it just demonstrates, again, the potential dangers of using public Wi-Fi. I mean, it takes a bit of spelunking through this columnist's Twitter feed to figure out exactly what happened, that he was using an Earthlink email service that, however it was set up, it wasn't set up to encrypt the traffic between his mail client and the Earthlink server. Now, technical listeners will be very correct and right in saying, well, there you go. What did you expect doing plain text comms over public Wi-Fi? Indeed, okay, spin the propeller. Indeed, when we talked about this in the last episode, I'd specifically called out the need to encrypt email protocol, POP, IMAP, SMTP, all the three or four letter acronyms should be going over SSL, secure sockets layer for those not catching up with the acronyms. But anyhow, but that's not the default configuration for many email clients, including Outlook. And, I don't know, the last time I checked, the iPhone mail client. I mean, you got to go sort of poking around in the settings, changing ports. I mean, I know how to do it, but it's nothing my wife would. So, building on Peter Zurich's suggestion, probably the easiest thing to do is to use the web email client, kind of like Gmail, over HTTPS, when the green lock shows up in the browser address bar. I mean, the next easiest is to set up your email client to encrypt its traffic, digging into the settings, like I said. Now, most email providers now provide those instructions on their sites, but I don't know, but perhaps the fiddliest, but the most secure, as Peter mentions, is to install and use a VPN. Now, if your company, if your company PC or handheld, comes with a VPN, then it's easy. Although you got to remember that VPN web traffic is usually tracked, through your company, just like it was coming out of your office. If it's your own device, then you're probably going to want to buy a service. I mean, it's not overly expensive, maybe $3 to $8 a month. I use ExpressVPN, which is on the pricier side, but their VPN client is easy to install and use, and kind of it has the side benefit of letting me watch NCAA March Madness video streams when I'm overseas. Now, this month, I'm also going to be trying a hardware-based VPN solution. It's called Always Home, which sets up a VPN using matching USB dongles. I don't know, it could be an easier solution. I'll report back in the next episode. Now, Dan Gradwall, before he poked me into action about getting this episode done, had what I would say was a reaction to a comment that I made in the last episode about Spirit Airlines passing Delta as the third largest in Chicago O'Hare. Now, looking at January schedules, he found Spirit had 29 daily departures, and that compared to Delta's 52. Would seem like Delta is still larger. However, the Crane's Chicago article that I had quoted said that Spirit carried more passengers than Delta, which could be since some of Delta's 52 departures were co-branded with smaller regional jets. Now, this kind of confusion between, who's bigger or what's the metric that you use to figure out who's bigger, passenger traffic or takeoffs or what they call plane movements. I mean, this is not a new thing. For a long time, Chicago O'Hare continued to claim the title of world's busiest airport based on the number of takeoffs and landings, which, and by that measure, it had reclaimed this number in 2014, long after Atlanta Hartsfield had passed it on total passengers handled. Using that stat, total passengers handled, O'Hare is the fourth largest airport after Atlanta, Beijing, and Dubai. Now, all that being said, Spirit is ramping up hard in the Chicago market, hiring new flight attendants ahead of plane deliveries. A friend of mine's son just got hired, and they're pushing the city for more gate space. And with Delta and American rolling out new economy basics fares to fight Spirit, they are, they're making traction. Might not be too long before Spirit passes Delta at O'Hare with both measures. Back in episode 117, I raved about a fintech company called Revolut. It offered a convenient and low-cost way to exchange, transfer, and access money internationally. I started using it last September when my daughter started up at University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I used it to convert and push money to her UK bank account and used the Revolut chip and PIN debit card to avoid the hassles of, US chip and signature credit cards. A couple of weeks, though, the low-cost component of Revolut's value proposition disappeared, at least for U.S. customers, when they added a 3% fee when you sort of topped up or added money to your Revolut account using a U.S. debit card. They said they were just sort of passing the fees through that they were being charged, and that's a claim I don't doubt. However, it started me looking for a cheaper foreign exchange option, which sort of led me down quite the rabbit hole, sorting through the differences in transaction costs and exchange rates, sort of quickly led to an Excel modeling session, which is, you know, just how you always want to spend your Saturday morning. Now, if you look at my Twitter feed, there's a string of tweets walking through my analysis. But, you know, for my case, TransferWise, another UK fintech startup, and Xoom, X-O-O-M, owned by PayPal, ended up being much cheaper than Revolut after considering Revolut's new 3% fee. I expect that I'll still use Revolut a bit when in Europe, say at, you know, self-service checkouts or gas pumps, but nowhere near the volume I was using it before that 3% fee hit. You know, but I'm glad to have options and, you know, do a little bit of math. I'm happy to do the math to avoid, say, a $50 bank wire fee or Western Union 7% premium over market exchange rates. It's, you know, it's nice to have those options. Hey, if you have any thoughts, questions, a story, a comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, C-O-M-M-E-N-T-S, at traveltocommons.com. You can always use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always go old school and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is, where do guidebooks fit? As I mentioned in the opening, my son and I are hitting Iceland this month for a four-day weekend. We've never been before, so I needed to figure out what to do and where to stay. And right about then, someone from what I used to know as Dorling Kindersley, now shortened to DK, pinged me about their February relaunch of DK's Eyewitness Travel Top 10 Guides. That's a mouthful. And it turned out one of the first 10 that they were launching is for Iceland. So it started me thinking about sort of where do guidebooks fit these days? You know, where do they fit in with the world of apps, say like Yelp and Foursquare and Untapped, podcasts, sort of, you know, Chris Christensen's Amateur Traveler podcast or Chris and Linda Martin's, Indie Travel podcast, you know, websites like TripAdvisor, newspaper articles, say like the New York Times 36 Hours in Reykjavik. And, you know, and then, you know, even friends' social media posts, say on Facebook and Instagram. Now, when I want to torture my kids, I do the when I was young thing. But, you know, going back to my wife's and my honeymoon 25 years ago, which is, you know, this November, so I got to get planning something. Just note to self. I cashed in a slug of British Airways miles to fly us first class to Pisa, and then we did a touring holiday in Tuscany. Now, the only plans I had made were to rent a car, a Fiat Panda, which that was entertaining, and to book our first night's room via Telex in Lucca. We ran the rest of the vacation off of a set of Michelin guides, the red one to find hotels and restaurants and the green one to figure out what to see. I mean, between those and sort of reading E.M. Foster's A Room with a View, we were set. We exchanged American Express traveler's checks at the bank for lira. We took pictures on Kodak and Fuji film. We navigated using paper maps. Wait, I mean, you can see where this is going. I mean, it's easy to kind of run down the nostalgic trip. I think my kids are somewhere in the background screaming, "Just stop it, Dad!" You know, I think like everybody else nowadays. Now, in the digital present, I start with a Google search: what to do in Iceland in March, and sort of limiting the search to the past 2 years, and then just start clicking. I mean, now there are a lot of articles from UK papers. I think that's because Wow Air, there it is again, Wow Air, like I said, sort of the Icelandic version of Spirit or EasyJet, you know, given that they're flying into London Gatwick, I think that's, you know, that's generated a lot of UK interest in Iceland. Well, anyhow, you know, I look at those articles and I clip them over to Evernote using, you know, Evernote's nifty little Chrome extension. And I sort of, you know, start to narrow the search down to specific interests like Iceland craft beer and get a few more articles that get synced back to Evernote. And I don't know, I stack up a bunch of facts, sort of a pointillist view of what to do in Iceland. Now, every survey about how people go about travel planning will tell you that personal recommendations are, you know, far and away the most important source of travel planning information, which makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, you know the person, how their interests, how the ways they travel align with yours. I mean, we've got good friends that we'll take, you know, we'll take restaurant recommendations from, but not hotel recommendations. I mean, we share the same taste and sort of interesting food, but they like to stay in hotels with nice pools, and we tend to stay a bit more, I don't know, closer to the ground, say choosing vacation rentals over a Westin resort. And then once people find that you travel a lot and that you're going to different sort of interesting places, you actually get a lot of inbound requests for recommendations. A friend of mine, a longtime Travel Commons listener, Alan Marco, curates a list of notes from, you know, his favorite European cities, places like Paris, that he'll just, you know, he's just got the list and you ask him, ping him, he regularly emails those out. And for me, after a couple of our visits to Spain, you know, I've kind of taken it to the next level of geekdom, sort of embedding my recommendations in a customized Google Map page. And then when people ping me, I just send them out the URL. Now, for the Iceland trip, a friend from work sent me the itinerary that she and her family did last summer. I'm not sure that she and her husband would be searching out craft beer bars with two young kids in tow, but I did take her recommendation, one of her hotel recommendations, the Hotel Geyser at the top of the Golden Circle route, and her recommendation about hitting the Blue Lagoon on the way back to the airport. I like the New York Times 36 Hours and the United Airlines Three Perfect Days series. I use those a lot also. They're focused on kind of that long weekend getaway. If you've got a limited amount of time, here's what you do. Now, these are the sorts of articles that we used to, back in the pre-digital days, kind of rip out of the Sunday travel section of the local newspaper or out of a travel magazine. We'd stash them in a travel folder. Now, I don't know, the internet has shifted that behavior a bit. We now search for them when we need them, right before we need them. And you know, I don't know, perhaps more for travel planning than for inspiration, but they sort of serve the same purpose as the Green Michelin Guide did for our honeymoon, a curated list of things you ought to go see. Now, that the DK Top 10 Iceland Guide, you know, flipping through that, I mean, came in useful kind of in that same way. You know, it seems to fit into this, you know, sort of hit the highlights mode, top 10 highlights by region and by thing. You know, sort of the top 10 churches, top 10 waterfalls, volcanoes, bars, cheap restaurants. They've got a 2-day and 7-day itinerary, which is nice because sort of the 36 hours in Reykjavik article I pulled up was from 2013, maybe sort of on that ragged edge of up-to-dateness. And the DK guide had everything sort of nicely packaged, which I remember from the Dorling Kindersley books of old. You know, all the lists in one place, you know, sort of wrapped up with a sturdy cover, and they've got fold-out maps in the front of Iceland and in the back of downtown Reykjavik, which is, you know, handy if you didn't plan ahead and cache Google Maps data before leaving the hotel Wi-Fi bubble. Now, there's another kind of guidebook that I'll use, though I couldn't find one for Iceland. They're less about lists and more about stories. Sort of think, you know, Bill Bryson's Notes from a Small Island about the UK, or more recently, Rice Noodle Fish, an Anthony Bourdain book by Matt Golding, whatever that string means. But anyhow, Rice Noodle Fish is about Japan, and specifically about food in Japan, as you would guess from the title, and the fact that Bourdain's involved with it. Anyhow, I read those more before I travel rather than packing them in my bag. They're more about context and texture, kind of, you know, kind of like what Room with a View was for us before Florence 25 years ago, that, you know, they prepare rather than guide you and maybe give you a bit more appreciation, like I said, context when you're kind of running through that top 10 highlights list. And I don't know, maybe it comes down to the kind of reader that you are. Are you someone who likes things more tangible than electronic? Do you like to flip pages rather than flip screens? I mean, you know, the Kindle cannibalized a good chunk of the demand for physical books, but it didn't replace it. Just like the overall book market, recent numbers show that the demand for physical guidebooks has sort of stabilized, albeit at a lower level. You know, I tell you, I sort of split the difference. I like paging through my Evernote virtual travel folder when I'm back at, you know, back in the hotel room or back at the vacation rental room. But I like to have a physical map and a physical list when I'm out walking during the day. I don't know, maybe that physicality keeps me more engaged with where I am, or at least it keeps me looking up and forward. I don't know, which should help me avoid what is, I think, the new traveler's epidemic, death by GPS. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, I hate shopping for a suitcase. I've been traveling for a few months now with the Blue Smart suitcase. I've mentioned that in a past episode when I pre-ordered it through their Indiegogo campaign. I have to look back. I think it was like $250, $275, something like that. And now that they're shipping, they're making a lot of, you know, sort of top traveler gadget lists. Now, Blue Smart claims to be the first piece of smart luggage to hit the market. It pairs with my iPhone through Bluetooth. It automatically locks when I step away from it and then unlocks itself when I return. There's a built-in battery to power itself and charge personal electronics through a couple of USB ports. It also periodically sends out its location, which I can then check with, you know, through the iPhone app. And it has a cool kind of front light that glows blue when it's paired with my phone. I think I like that best of all. Now, aside from all the electronics, it's a hard shell wheelie bag with really some nice sized wheels that roll easily, sometimes a bit too easily. It fits perfectly in American's and United Airlines luggage sizers, at least the ones in Boston Logan Airport. Now, I got to tell you, some blogger who reviewed this bag raised, you know, kind of a little bit of a ruckus saying that the bag dimensions on the website were too big for a carry-on. I guess the guy doesn't travel enough to actually go to an airport and check it out himself. But I did, and they fit. The iPhone app is getting a bit better. I haven't tried, I'm not even sure if they've got an Android app yet, but the iPhone app is getting better. I mean, it was a little wonky when it first came out, but Blue Smart is doing a nice job of revving the app frequently to stomp out bugs and improve performance. Though, I don't know, the location alerts, you know, they kind of pop up. You're leaving me behind when you walk, theoretically, when you walk away from the bag. They're still a little bit wonky because I'll be sitting next to the bag and I get these whiny little notifications. So that's probably something they're still working on. All in all, it's a nice enough bag. I mean, I had been thinking about getting something a bit smaller for, you know, sort of the 1 to 2 night trips, and this fits the bill. I mean, again, it's a nice bag. I'm I can take it or leave it on all the electronics. I mean, the large battery is fine, but I already carry a recharger in my backpack that'll top up my iPhone or tablet a couple of times, and which is good enough, and it's actually more accessible in flight than my bag being stuffed in the overhead. The location functionality seems to work only when I press the button to wake up the bag, which means I'm sort of right beside the bag and I sort of then know its location. And since the bag is the perfect carry-on size, which I think is actually a strong point for it, or it's usually right above me in the plane cabin. So all in all, it's a nice enough hard shell wheelie bag with a couple of bells and whistles that don't necessarily wow me. Which should not be interpreted as a knock against Blue Smart. I'm sure that there are a number of travelers who love every one of those bells and whistles. I mean, it's not so much a criticism about Blue Smart as it is about, I don't know, how personal and idiosyncratic frequent travelers are about suitcases. I mean, you know, it's got to fit your packing strategies, which are also very idiosyncratic. I mean, some people love compartments to help them structure their packing. Some people roll everything up very nicely. Me, I'm all about the flexibility of a single open space. I sort of build my own structure with shoes and different kind of clothes, depending on the trip. And I also tend to sort of lay things flat and, you know, fold them around cardboard that comes with my shirts. And again, we've all got our thing, and you tend to buy a bag that kind of fits your thing. And I got to tell you, even though I see more and more hard shell bags, and now I own one, but I'm not completely sold on them yet. I don't know. I still like that ability that the soft shell likes to, you know, it lets you bulge when you need to. And I don't know, the two versus four wheel thing, pushing a four wheel through the airport seems a bit easier on sort of my wrists and forearms. But I don't know, sometimes they roll a bit too easy and won't stay put. So I don't know. You know, it's the reason I've been walking around, I think, with a ripped backpack for 4 months. I really hate shopping for travel bags. It's such a personal thing, and I hate even just thinking about it. And so I don't know. I know I got to do it. I know I got to get this backpack replaced, but I don't even know where I'm going with that. All I can say is that I'm really very happy that leather wallets last a real long time. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Treble Commons podcast number 120. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. Remember, you can always find us on iTunes. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on the web. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter. And I don't know, I think Google Music is going to start picking up podcasts. I've pushed out Treble Commons into that. And I don't know, if you find some place that I'm not, that you'd like me to be at, just shoot me a note. There's podcasts are big. if you've got a story, thought, a comment, a gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. Always ping me on Twitter at mpeacock. Write them on the Travel Commons wall. On Facebook, post them on the website at travelcommons.com. I think that's all my interaction channels. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, like Peter Zurich and Dan Granwald, tweets, posting comments on the website. I always appreciate it because it gives me content. I'm always looking for content. So again, so I ought to get some content going to Iceland and Spain in a couple of weeks. So the next episode, hopefully I won't need Dan to kick me in the butt to get it out next time. But until we talk again, travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.